Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller, featuring Smitten Kitchen. We're going to start off today with a recipe for breakfast or lunch, spinach and smashed egg toast. What do you make yourself for lunch if nobody else is around? I bet you're hoping I'm going to say something ambitious like a gently poached chicken breast, cooled and sliced across a vegetable salad with a hand-whisked vinaigrette. Because that happens, ever. Or maybe you're hoping that this is where I'll tell you about my secret peanut butter fluff with crumbled potato chip sandwich habit. Alas, I'm not even interesting enough at lunchtime to be scandalous. The sad truth is, if I've by some miracle found a couple of hours to get work done in relative peace, I'm ecstatic, and I find hunger an inconvenience. If I must succumb, whatever I make for lunch must be quick and tends to fall into the stuff on bread category. Avocado, olive oil, lemon and sea salt, peanut butter, always lowbrow, and jam, always fancy, or smash soft egg. I made a big fuss about poaching eggs a few years ago because I loved them, but had a hard time getting them right at home. Once I did, I was triumphant, but nevertheless have probably not made one in over a year, or not since I discovered that there's an even simpler route to that cooked, white, loose, yolk, soft edge nirvana. Soft-boiled eggs require no vinegar, no teeming water, and no whirlpools, but they peel like a dream. My favorite way to eat them is broken open on toasted and buttered whole grain bread, sprinkled with sea salt and freshly ground black pepper. But sometimes, I make an effort. When I do, it looks like this. The same smashed egg, but wedged between it and the toast is a bed of spinach. A handful left over from last night's salad greens is perfect. Gently wilted and minced shallots, a smidge of cream, a few cheese crumbles, and a near invisible slick of Dijon mustard that makes all the difference. It sounds fancy and it might feel a tiny bit fussy the first time you make it. I have not forgotten that the cardinal rule of quick meals is that they must only require the use of one pot, and here, but since you're alone in the kitchen, I think that a pot only used to boil an egg is still totally clean, right? But if you're anything like me, you're going to have a habit out of it, and by the second time you make it, you'll have it down. You might even plan ahead, keeping a container of minced onion in the fridge, making sure you hold back a bowl full of spinach at dinner, etc. But beyond the fact that it's nutritious, a whole bunch of spinach, indulgent, toast, butter, cheese, and crazy delicious, toast, butter, cheese. I think you're going to make it again and again for the same reason I do, which is that smashing a soft, centered egg on toast with a big fork, essentially the kitchen equivalent of popping bubble wrap, is about the most fun one can have on a quick workday break. And with that, I'm off to do it again. Here's the recipe, spinach and smashed egg toast. I use the spinach method scaled up all the time to make a quick, lazy creamed spinach with dinner. A more classic one is here, and there is a link at smittenkitchen.com, and an even more gussied one here. Creme fraiche could replace the cream. Unlike yogurt or sour cream, it doesn't curdle when heated. You'll need one large egg, one slice of your favorite hearty bread, 2 ounces of baby spinach, 1 pat of butter, 1 tablespoon minced shallot or white onion, 1 tablespoon heavy cream, sea salt and freshly ground black pepper, 1 teaspoon of smooth Dijon mustard, 1 tablespoon of crumbled cheese, such as goat cheese or feta. You're going to bring a small pot of water to boil and lower the egg into it and boil for 5, for a runnier egg as I've seen at the top photo, to 6 minutes for a less runny but still loose egg, as seen in the bottom photo. Rinse the egg briefly under cool water and set aside. Wash your spinach, but no need to dry it. Put a small puddle of water in the bottom of a skillet and heat it over medium high. Once the water is simmering, add the spinach and cook it until it is just wilted and not a moment longer. Transfer it to a colander and press as much of the excess water out with the back of a fork as possible. No need to wring it out here. We're hoping to use those lovely wilted leaves or keep them intact. Keep that fork. You will use it again in a moment. Put your bread in to toast and then dry your skillet if it's still wet. You're going to heat a pat of butter in it over medium-low heat and add shallots and cook them for a few minutes until translucent and a little sweet. Return the spinach to the skillet and add cream. Simmer them together for 1 minute and then season with salt and freshly ground black pepper. Put your toast on your plate and spread it thinly with Dijon mustard. Heap the spinach and shallot mixture on top and then add the crumbled cheese. Peel your egg. Doing so under running water can make this easier. And once peeled, place it on your spinach toast, smash it open with the back of that fork you used a minute ago, and sprinkle it with salt and freshly ground black pepper. Eat immediately. When you're eating a soft-boiled egg right away, 6 minutes is the way to go. But here, since we boil the egg and then prepare the rest of the toast, it continues to cook and firm up a bit in its shell. So I've found that 5 to 5.5 minute egg will give you the equivalent in the end. Next, we've got a recipe for not your mama's coleslaw. Look, I understand that it's too early in the day to start thinking about mothers. At the age of 30, when I say mother, what I really mean is me sooner than later. So it sounds a particularly ill-chosen term, not to mention that my mother is a wonderful cook, as is my husband's mother, as was her mother. And what I really actually mean is, this is not your fill-in-the-blank deli's / lunchroom's typical watery, soggy, oil, white, mysterious 2-ounce solo container of forgettable and soon-to-be-chucked coleslaw. But that makes for a terrifically bad headline. Like most of it, I've never been a fan of coleslaw, as nearly everyone I had ever tried was god-awful. I thought it was because I didn't like cabbage, but this has turned out to be not the case. Then I thought it was because I didn't like mayonnaise, but this too turned out to be a farce. An aside, have you ever made mayo? It's really easy. I should totally do it all the time. As it turned out, it was coleslaw, the way it was typically prepared, reed scooped from a bucket of mysterious origin and packing date, that I loathed. Ding, 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 we have a winner. As is all too common theme on this site, Ms. Contessa saved the day with her fresh take on everything you've grown bored with. Don't think coleslaw, think cabbage salad. Don't think white, as these pictures show it to be anything but. Soggy? No. The trick is to keep the dressing and the veggies separate as you would with any other salad. Dull? Heck no. Forgettable? Anything but, though you'll have to try it for yourself to believe me. Now, the recipe does make an excessive volume of dressing, but it keeps forever and doubles excellently as a dip for raw veggies. In addition, cabbage, when bought fresh, keeps for weeks and weeks in the refrigerator. I wasn't going to bring this up, but we used a half head to make this in June, and in August found the remainder wrapped, flawless, unbruised, and age mark-free in the back of the crisper. I'm going to leave the jury out on whether we dig in. So here's the recipe for not your mama's coleslaw. Serves 8 to 10, takes 30 minutes, and the source is in a garden. Here's how I get this salad ready for picnics, potlucks, and other summer flings. I prepare the cabbage and carrots and keep them in a big container or a gallon bag. I make the dressing and keep it in a big jar. And when needed, I assemble what we need with chopped parsley. The parsley doesn't add a significant flavor, but it does make the salad look like a showstopper. You could also use ribbons of kale for a modern twist. I don't use the blue cheese as often, but if you've got friends and family who like it, they will love it here. The prepared vegetables without dressing will keep for 5 days in a bag. The dressing without blue cheese keeps, well, I can't say forever, but there's honestly not one thing in there that shouldn't keep for a month or two. We keep it in an airtight jar in the fridge. With blue cheese, I would use it within a week. This makes too much dressing for this quantity of salad, and we have never used it all, but it keeps well and also makes an awesome dip for crudités. So here we go. We will need 2 cups of mayonnaise. Low fat is fine, as is swapping half with yogurt. 1/4 cup of smooth Dijon mustard. 3 tablespoons of whole grain mustard. I use whole grain Dijon. 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar. 1 teaspoon of celery seed. 1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt. 1/2 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper. 1 1/2 cups of crumbled blue cheese. This is optional. 1/2 of a small head of green cabbage. 1/2 of a small head of red cabbage. And 1 giant carrot, or 4 slim ones, scrubbed or peeled and shredded. 1 cup of chopped fresh parsley leaves, or 1 cup of slivered kale leaves. To make the dressing, you're going to mix the mayonnaise, mustards, vinegar, celery seed, salt, and pepper in a smaller bowl. Stir in the blue cheese if you're using. To prepare the vegetables, halve the cabbage halves and cut out the cores. Slice the cabbage as thinly as you can with a sharp knife, on a mandoline, or with a food processor slicing blade. You can lay the cabbage horizontally in the feeding tube. Then transfer the chopped cabbage into a large bowl, fishing out any very large pieces and slicing them thinly by hand. Stir in the shredded carrot, and if you're going to dress this later, this is the best stopping point. To serve, up to an hour before you'll eat the slaw, toss the cabbage mixture with a dressing to taste. You'll want to start with half and add more as needed, and parsley. Adjust the seasonings as needed. Note, no matter how gargantuan the salad looks right now, it will soon wilt down a bit and yield moderate portions for 8 to 10 people. So our next recipe is going to be for pasta and white beans with garlic rosemary oil. If you have a thing for chocolate, the world is your oyster. On this very site, 86 of the just over 800 recipes boast a significant chocolate component, and entire sections of bookstores will be happy to fill in any cravings that I missed. If you have a thing for bacon, the internet would be overjoyed to find you places to put it. Zillions, even, although I'd proceed with caution before auditioning a couple of them. But if you have a thing for something slight less of a prom king queen ingredient, say tiny white beans, well, it can be tough, because there's not no uses for them. It's just that when you're very much in love, there are never enough ways to be together. And if you're me, someone who sometimes ups and makes a mega pot of white beans just because you feel like it, presuming you'll find things to do with them later, you sometimes end up scrambling, yanking down nearly every cookbook in your collection, but still coming up bereft of uses outside of the well-trodden soup and salad territory. So tell me, where are your favorite uses for beans outside the ever-popular realm of chili, tacos, soup, and salad? Really, I'm hankering for more inspiration. I ended up finding some, but never enough, in this month's Bon Appetit, and a stack of pasta recipes you'll find it impossible to choose among, from Sarah Jenkins of Porchetta and Porcina, and Green Bean Salad fame. I was so charmed by the short tubes of pasta and chickpeas, I made it almost immediately, but maybe it was because I've overdone it on chickpeas this month, but I kept thinking it would be nice with something daintier. And considering that it's an established fact, I'm in Italy, where I suspect both my white bean and artichoke obsessions could roam free, that white beans, garlic, and rosemary and olive oil are a combination sent from above, and I had a hunch that they'd be happy here too. The result is a great pasta for this time of year, deeply comforting and hearty, but not overly decadent. There's no heavy cream or cheese or dairy at all. There's no bacon, sorry, or even a pinch of meat. If you won't miss any of these things because, like a certain soup that I have missed immensely since last week, it's the finish that makes the dish. In this case, a sizzling oil with not just garlic, but freshly minced rosemary, too. If you finish that with a few pinches of salt, sea salt, oh boy, you'll see. It'll make a convert out of you, too. So here's the recipe. Pasta and white beans with sizzling garlic rosemary oil. This is adapted just barely from Sarah Jenkins via Bon Appetit. For the pasta, I used penne because I thought it nicely matched the little white beans. This is Rancho Gordo's Alubia Blanca. Sarah Jenkins called for ditalini to go with chickpeas. You can use whatever you'd like. Short tubes, even elbows, and canned beans are just fine here. I streamlined the recipe a bit to reduce the number of bowls and pots used because I'm having the kind of week where if I see another dirty dish, I'm a run far away. Just to make things easier. This makes a lot of pasta because you're using a whole pound plus 2 cans of beans, so it's a great recipe to consider if you wish to finish it before spring comes. You'll need 1 medium onion cut into big chunks, 1 medium carrot in big chunks, 1 celery stalk in big chunks, 6 garlic cloves, 4 left whole, 2 finely chopped, 1/2 cup of flat leaf parsley leaves, 1/4 teaspoon of crushed red pepper flakes, or to taste, 1/2 cup of olive oil divided, coarse or kosher salt, 2 to 3 tablespoons of tomato paste, 3 1/2 cups of cooked drained beans. You can save the cooking liquid for water in the recipe if desired, or 2 15-ounce cans of small white beans, such as Great Northern or Cannellini, rinsed. You'll need 1 pound of short tube pasta and 1 tablespoon of minced fresh rosemary. Pulse the onion, carrot, celery, whole garlic cloves, parsley, and red pepper flakes to taste in a food processor until finely chopped. Heat 1/4 cup of oil in a large heavy pot over medium heat and add the vegetable mixture to the pot. Quickly rinse, but no need to fully wash the food processor as you will use it again shortly. Season generously with salt and then cook, stirring from time to time until the vegetables take on a bit of color, about 10 minutes. Add tomato paste. The original recipe calls for 2 tablespoons, but we enjoyed it with 3. And cook it into the vegetables for another minute. Add 1 cup of water or bean cooking liquid and use it to scrape up any bits stuck to the pot. Let simmer until the liquid has almost disappeared, about 5 to 8 minutes. Add beans and 2 more cups of water or bean cooking liquid to the pot and simmer until the flavors meld, about another 15 minutes. Meanwhile, cook the pasta until al dente or still a little firm inside. I know you didn't ask for one, but can I insert an argument for al dente pasta here? The thing is, you don't want your pasta to fully cook in the water. If you do, it won't have the absorbency left to drink up and become one with that delicious sauce. I have really found that finishing pasta in its sauce is the single thing that most swiftly improved the quality of my pasta dishes. You're going to reserve 1 1/2 cups of cooking water from your drained pasta and transfer 1 cup of the bean mixture to your rinsed food processor and puree it until smooth and then stir it back into the sauce to thicken it. Add the drained pasta and 1/2 cup of cooking liquid to the bean sauce and cook the mixture together, adding more pasta cooking liquid as needed until the sauce coats the pasta about 1 to 2 more minutes. To serve, heat the remaining 1/4 cup of olive oil in a tiny saucepan over medium-low heat with garlic and rosemary until the sizzling stops. Divide the pasta between serving bowls and drizzle the garlic rosemary oil over each. If you're us, you'll finish this with a few flakes of sea salt and then eat at once. Next, we've got a recipe for peppermint hot fudge sauce, just for dessert. You'll have all of your holiday shopping done, right? This was obviously written in December. I bet everything is wrapped up in gift bags, and you know how to tie ribbons into bows without cursing. I suspect everyone but me knows how to fluff, is that what they call it? I bet everyone knows how to arrange the tissue paper inside the gift bags so that it looks perfectly festive and even a tad enthusiastic. I have a hunch that your gifts are homemade and hand-lettered, that you made your own cards. Oh, you didn't? Well, come sit down over here. You're among friends. I ran to Duane Reade this morning and bought a roll of brown shipping paper and decided at once that the gift wrap theme this year would be rustic. I also wiped out the gift bag supply. Sorry about that. Then I went home and made my first homemade gift. Yes, I know it is both Hanukkah and Christmas week, but I don't like to be rushed. Plus, if you only have time this week to warm hearts and minds with but a single homemade treat, I hardly think this would be an unwelcome choice. I've made hot fudge sauce before. I shared the recipe that my mother always made from her worn copy of that Silver Palette cookbook a few years ago. But as it turns out, I have room in my heart and ladled over my ice cream for two hot fudge sauces. This one hails from the late gourmet, and I decked it out for the holidays with some peppermint extract and some poor candy cane that had an unfortunate run-in with one of the most random but secretly delightful kitchen purchases that I've made this year. The earlier hot fudge sauce was a bit on the bittersweet side and can be a tiny bit tricky in that a small amount of overcooking can lead to grittiness and the dreaded separation of cocoa solids. This is less bitter, harder to mess up, and reheats wonderfully. Poured over a scoop of ice cream, it stops quickly in its tracks and cools to the hallmarked fudge sauce stage of slight chewiness. This is kind of my favorite part. But it smells the way that I imagine the Junior Mint Factory must smell, like the heavens above. I will probably never fulfill my fantasy of sneaking into it unnoticed and falling asleep in a pile of soft blankets under a bubbling cauldron of chocolate and mint, with visions of peppermint patties and layered brownies dancing in my head. But now that I have this in the fridge, I don't feel as bad about it. Here's the recipe. Peppermint hot fudge sauce adapted just a bit from gourmet. Now that one needs a reason to embrace hot fudge sauce, I mean, other than it's Monday and there's ice cream in the freezer, but one of the things that brought this on was that I found a product called Golden Syrup on the grocery store shelf when I hadn't expected to. And this has kicked off a slew of cooking that has usually limited to corn syrup. Golden Syrup is a pure cane syrup that can be used instead of corn syrup in most candy and caramel recipes, and tastes infinitely better as it has a slight caramel flavor to it. If you live outside the U.S., especially in the U.K., you've probably been using it your whole life, but here it's still a specialty item. I took the fact that the Whole Foods in Houston was selling it on two different packages, canned and bottled, as a sign that this is probably slowly changing. It's also sold online, and there's a couple of links here at smittenkitchen.com. Google can point them out for you if it needed. If you cannot get golden syrup and don't wish to use corn syrup, both honey and maple syrup will work as well, but of course they impart different flavors. As far as canning, yes, I know I tempted you with tiny jars of ready-to-gift fudge, and I didn't mean to be a tease, but it's just that products with dairy in them, and this has a ton, are not safe to can. But I see no reason why you can't simply leave a note that it should be kept in the fridge and used within a week or two, right? So this makes about 2 cups. You'll need 2/3 cup of heavy or whipping cream, 1/2 cup of light corn syrup or golden syrup, 1/3 cup of packed dark brown sugar, 1/4 cup of unsweetened cocoa powder, ideally Dutch processed, heaping 1/4 teaspoon of fine sea salt or level 1/4 teaspoon of table salt, 6 ounces of bittersweet chocolate, chopped or about 1 cup of bittersweet chocolate chips, divided. 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter, 1/4 teaspoon of peppermint extract or to taste, and crushed candy canes for serving. This is optional. In a 1.5 to 2 quart heavy saucepan, bring the cream, syrup, sugar, cocoa, salt, if you'd like the salt to remain slightly textured, add it with the butter and extract at the end, and have the chocolate to a boil, and half of the chocolate to a boil. Reduce to a low simmer and cook for 5 minutes, stirring occasionally. Remove from the heat and stir in the remaining chocolate, butter, and extract, and stir until smooth. Cool the sauce to warm before serving so that it can thicken up. And while it's very hot, it will only slide off the ice cream and pool in the alleys of the bowl. And that would be tragic, right? As far as doing ahead, the sauce keeps in the fridge for a week, according to Gourmet, though we've kept it longer, closer to 2 weeks, and live to tell about it. Reheat gently before serving so that it's still thick but just loose enough to pour. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.